It's a pleasure to be here. I'll share with you some of the lessons that we've learned from the Framingham Heart Study. We're in our 65th year now. I think a requirement for most talks is a disclosure of relationships, and these are the relationships I'm disclosing. For the next 20 minutes, I'll bring you to the town of Framingham, Massachusetts. For those of you who are from out of town, Framingham is located about 20 miles west of where we are right now, and it's on actually on the pathway of the Boston Marathon. This is a sign that we see at several different intersections in Framingham. It says, "The town that changed America's heart," with a copy of the Framingham Heart Study logo. Home of the Framingham Heart Study. Here's a picture of our map, and the star on the right is where we are right now. Let's see if I could get the mouse working. We're located about here, and Framingham is located right over there. I'll take you back in time when we began the 20th century. We heard a little bit of this in Snehal's presentation. We were faced with a very different epidemiology of health and disease. At the beginning of the 20th century, the three leading causes of death in the United States were all infectious diseases, pneumonia, influenza, tuberculosis, and infectious diarrhea. And at that time, life expectancy of a baby born in our country was about 50 years. Let's fast forward to today, and the leading causes of death are all chronic diseases, heart disease, cancer, and stroke. The first and third causes of death together kill about 1 million people each year in our country. And the life expectancy of a baby born in our country is in the range of about 80 years. In other words, over the course of just about one century, we've increased life expectancy for a baby born in our country by more than 50%. This is a truly extraordinary accomplishment. We've dramatically changed the causes of death and changed prospects for our futures and those of our children. But let's go back in time and understand how some of these changes came about. This is a picture from a New York Times obituary a few months ago. I happened to come across this while reading the Times online. And in that one obituary page, you had George Shea dying at age 104, Pedro Vasquez at age 94, and Henry Prunier at age 91. We really are living much longer. But back in the midpoint of the 20th century, people didn't understand very much about the underlying causes of disease. And in fact, if you go back to our media, we see that some people were happy because they ate lard. And physicians, in some ways, may have been part of the problem, not just part of its solution. The wake-up call for our country in terms of the changing epidemiology of the things we die from, in my opinion, occurred on April 12, 1945. Anyone know what happened on that day? This is a very shy group. But let's think we're a little bit more intimate and can actually share our thoughts with each other for a moment. What happened on that day? It's going to be a very long talk if no one speaks up. No, that was, I think that was in November or December of that year. Victory over Europe. The war in Europe had already ended by April of 1945. April of 1945 was the day President Roosevelt died. And it was, for some people, a shocking development that occurred out of the blue. In fact, the press secretary, Stephen Early, was interviewed by the New York Times the next day and was totally alarmed by the president's death. He said the president was given a thorough examination by seven or eight physicians, including some of the most eminent in the country, and was pronounced organically sound in every way. In other words, his death came as a shock. But if you go back and actually look at some of the evidence, and I've done so. We know that a normal blood pressure is a systolic pressure of less than 120 or a diastolic of less than 90. In 1931, when Roosevelt was a relatively young man, he was governor of New York running for the presidency for the first of four times, his blood pressure then was already elevated at 140 over 100. In 1937, after being elected for his second term, his blood pressure was 170 over 100. 1941, in his third term, his blood pressure was 188 over 105. And in 1944, during the height of World War II, his blood pressures were running around 200 over 110, very high blood pressure levels. And in fact, in February of 1945, when he traveled 14,000 miles by boat to Yalta to meet with Stalin, shown on the right in this slide, and the empty seat on the other side would be occupied by Winston Churchill, his blood pressure at the time of this famous Yalta meeting was 260 over 150. He died on April 12th. His last recorded blood pressure was 300 over 190. In fact, he was in Warm Springs, Georgia, where he had been sent to convalesce after that long trip to Europe. He was surrounded by some staff and his mistress, Lucy Mercer Rutherford, signing some documents, complained of a headache, grabbed the back of his head, and lost consciousness. He died of a massive stroke due to uncontrolled hypertension. So where were we when Roosevelt died, and what steps did we take to try to gain some insight into what by this point had become the leading cause of death in our country? Medical historian Gerald Oppenheimer came to visit us in Framingham a few years ago, and he wrote a really brilliant article about the emerging epidemic. In the mid-1940s, epidemiological knowledge about cardiovascular disease was extremely limited. We knew that half the deaths in our country were due to cardiovascular disease, but the mortality statistics that we had in hand from the government and from insurance companies was quite poor. And the underlying causes of cardiovascular disease was unknown. There were no effective treatments whatsoever. The town of Framingham was chosen for a large-scale prospective epidemiological study of cardiovascular disease. Framingham, this is a picture of downtown Framingham from about the early 1950s. And it's remarkable as I look at this picture how similar Framingham looks today, and I think even some of the same cars are on the roads. But Framingham was chosen for this large-scale study because it had been the site of a successful tuberculosis study back after World War I. Some of the local physicians in Framingham in 1948 had participated in the TB survey and could be counted on to help for this new study. Framingham was close to teaching hospitals and to Harvard and had a low unemployment rate. It was felt to be an ideal community to conduct a surveillance project. It was estimated when the study began that it would take 5,209 relatively healthy men and women, and they'd have to be followed for about 20 years before enough cardiovascular disease events would accrue in order to begin to connect the dots between some of the measurements made in these people at baseline and the development of disease over time. I can tell you that, in fact, the 5,209 men and women were brought in for extensive evaluations, a medical history, physical exam, laboratory test, chest x-ray, and electrocardiogram, and have been invited back every 2 years since. We're now in the midst of our 32nd cycle of exams on the same study participants. As expected, the leading cause of death has been cardiovascular disease, and it was through the development of cardiovascular disease in this carefully studied population that we've learned so much about some of its underlying causes. But I'm jumping ahead a little bit because, in fact, when the study began, the study lacked even the very tools to collect and analyze data. Computers were not available to analyze the data that were being collected. This is a picture from the RAND Corporation of what they, in 1950, believed the typical home computer would look like in the year 2000. And I look at this picture with disbelief and still wonder what the steering wheel is for. In any event, my colleagues, my predecessors in Framingham persevered. They collected data, continued to collect data. Eventually, the computers would come along that allowed for the analysis of those data. And in fact, analytical methods didn't even exist, and new types of analytical approaches for the analysis of longitudinal data were created expressly for the analysis of data coming from the Framingham Heart Study. These are three of my predecessors: Roy Dauber, who became director of the study in 1950, Bill Cannell, who succeeded Roy Dauber in 1966 as study director, and Joe Stokes, who joined the study in the early 1950s. I was privileged in my own career to have Bill Cannell and Joe Stokes as my mentors back then. And in 1961, a little earlier than the predicted 20-year time point, they had collected enough cardiovascular events that some of the early associations became evident. And this is a copy of the initial paper from Framingham, Factors of Risk in the Development of Coronary Heart Disease, 6-Year Follow-Up Experience from the Framingham Heart Study. And in this paper, Bill Cannell wrote, "Years of follow-up experience in the longitudinal prospective study of coronary heart disease in Framingham have confirmed the widely recognized influence of hypertension and hypercholesterolemia on the development of coronary heart disease." In other words, they identified some of the first factors contributing to the development of coronary heart disease. They used the term factors of risk. This term was very soon turned around to become risk factors for heart disease, and a common term that we use every day in common medical parlance and even lay parlance. And by describing these as risk factors or factors of risk, this opened up the opportunity for prevention. And the lessons learned here about blood pressure and cholesterol as the two very initial risk factors led to the conduct of clinical trials. We heard about clinical trials just a moment ago. It led to the very first clinical trials of blood pressure lowering and cholesterol lowering to determine if intervention against these modifiable factors of risk could alter the course of disease. And in fact, it turned out that blood pressure reduction and cholesterol lowering became two of the most powerful mechanisms that we had back then, and two of the most powerful approaches available to us to this very day to reduce patients' risk for heart disease. Today, we've enrolled not just the original study cohort, but beginning in 1971, we began the enrollment of their children. And beginning in 2002, we began the recruitment of a third generation of study participants, the offspring cohort. Some of the major achievements from Framingham were understanding heart disease risk factors, things like hypertension, cholesterol, obesity, diabetes, cigarette smoking, sedentary lifestyle, as well as a number of novel risk factors. In the year 2000, the Washington Post and the Merck Manual published a list of what they considered to be the 100 most important medical advances of the 20th century. At the very top of that list, not surprisingly, was the development of antibiotics that helped eradicate or at least treat many forms of infectious disease. Recall that in 1900, the leading causes of death were all infectious diseases. The number two most important advance was the use of mass immunizations or vaccines, and we heard about that in one of our lectures a few moments ago. The number three development was discovery of vitamins and improvements in nutrition. And fourth on that list was the Framingham Heart Study for the insights that it provided into understanding the causes of cardiovascular disease. But we're not resting on our laurels. This is a cover of Time magazine, Genetics, the Future is Now. It's a great slide because it never goes out of date. And some of the efforts that we're now engaged in to identify the next generation of risk factors in our next generations of study participants include things like our SABRE CVD initiative. This stands for Systems Approach to Biomarker Research in Cardiovascular Disease, with a goal of identifying molecular and biochemical signatures of atherosclerosis and metabolic risk factors using high-throughput omic technologies, proteomics, metabolomics, transcriptomics, genomics, etc. This project that we're engaged in right now involves four important components. The first is discovery proteomics and metabolomics. The second is targeted immunoassays of plasma proteins. The third is gene expression profiling. And the fourth is microRNA profiling. We will be collecting hundreds of thousands or millions of new potential biomarkers of risk and analyzing them. This approach is very different from the approach that I learned when I first joined Framingham right out of my cardiology training. And one might ask whether this new approach is simply a fishing expedition. And the answer is yes, it is, but we are catching quite a few fish. This is actually a picture of me just outside of Boston Harbor, right nearby where we are today. And some of our efforts in metabolomics and transcriptomics are helping us identify what may turn out to be the next group of risk factors to understand causes of cardiovascular disease and to initiate new approaches to its treatment and prevention. So in this way, we've taken the Framingham Heart Study. This is our logo. You see three interlinked hearts representing the three generations of study participants, but of course they're represented by a helical coil representing our DNA. Framingham, known most for its work in population research, but we've gone from the population level to being able to study our DNA, our genetic variation that makes each of us different. We've gone from our DNA to our RNA, the molecules coded for by our DNA that in turn code for the proteins that are critical for every life function. And we're measuring those proteins and the small molecules or metabolites they act upon with our proteomic and metabolomic research. We can put some of these types of data together and integrate them using systems biology approaches to join genetic data, transcriptomic data, and proteomic metabolomic data to understand how they work together to promote clinical disease. In doing so, we hope we will contribute to new advances in personalized medicine and approaches to the prevention and treatment of disease. Over the course of the last 40 to 50 years, we've seen steady and dramatic declines in death rates from heart disease and stroke in the range of 60 to 70%. I mentioned early on that the leading causes of death in the U.S. today are cardiovascular diseases. About a million people die each year of cardiovascular disease, and savings of 60 to 70% in death rates from cardiovascular disease represents a savings of hundreds of thousands of lives each year. Certainly much of the improvement in death from cardiovascular disease is owed to new approaches toward the treatment of people with disease, new types of interventions, but also much of this decline is attributable to improvements in prevention, declines in smoking, declines in lipid levels, declines in blood pressure, and improvements in awareness, treatment, and control of these modifiable risk factors. We believe that Framingham and the work that we did identifying some of these risk factors early on has contributed to public awareness of cardiovascular disease and its risk factors, as well as approaches to its prevention. And we hope that the work that we're doing today will identify the next group of risk factors to allow us to continue this downward trend in mortality from heart disease. Thank you very much. Thank you, Dr. Levy. We have time for a question. Is there some in the back there? What is the community's understanding of the study? And it's really quite interesting. The study participants initially all came from Framingham. Their children and grandchildren, many of them come from Framingham or the surrounding communities. We've been fairly proactive, both keeping our participants informed as well as keeping the community informed. In the early days, many of our first public releases of information about the data being collected and the results of publications were, in fact, shared with the local newspaper. The Metro West Daily News is the name of that newspaper today, and we would share it with them so that they could share that with the community and keep the community informed and engaged. So we consider engagement critical to our success, And we actually distribute a newsletter to all our study participants that they're aware of what we're doing, why we're doing it, the successes that we've had in order to keep them coming back for future exams.
Great. All right, thank you very much.